Hello and welcome to the Psychomedia Podcast. I'm Timothy Swan.
And I'm Ben Fell, and together we'll be looking at the funny side of psychology.
Which is something that we do our best to do every week. This is going to be our third episode. This week's topic is on romance, but we'll get to that after we've talked about a bit of feedback, because we have had some feedback for our second episode. I was getting a bit worried earlier in the week that we weren't going to hear anything back, so we'd have a really... I suppose we could have just cut the feedback section, but it would have been a noticeable omission. So yes, someone commented to me on Last.fm, I wanted to ease your anxiety about your inevitable death by thanking you for plugging the Psychomedia Podcast. I really enjoyed the first two entertaining and informative episodes. I think that guy is an overthinking it listener, so that's good. Good transference there.
Well, that's nice, particularly because we specifically asked people to give us positive feedback so that we'd feel less worried about our own death. So
oh, yeah, cool. Nice. It actually worked.
Yeah.
How amazing.
It's like a dialogue. It's amazing.
Okay, and then also someone else said, marvellous new podcast, highly enjoyable listen, just wish I could forget the hippocampus gag. Really enjoyed it. And that's from James, the host of the Monkey on My Back podcast, who we also get a lot of listeners from. David Wynn, who gave us some good feedback on our first episode, said the second episode was much better than the first. It was more funny this time, a better fusion of jokes and information. So that's, yeah, that's electric feedback to me.
That is good. And that's so death, not only preferable to Facebook, as we established in the last episode, but also preferable to the first episode.
Death is preferable to the first. Oh, you meant to say... Okay, I understand.
Sorry, that was slightly ambiguous. That's interesting as well. The what was the second piece of feedback? The one that you just gave from the... Yeah.
What, which one? Anyway, the second episode was better than the first, and that it was a highly enjoyable listen. I just wish I could forget about the hippocampus gag.
Yeah, the hippocampus. Wasn't that episode one?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're a busy person. They're a parent.
I suppose so. I've barely listened to the second episode.
Oh, I haven't even listened to the end of the first one yet, because I'm trying to listen to it with my family, which is tricky. Anyway, did anyone feedback anything to you, Ben?
Well, there was one thing that popped up on our Facebook pages, which is a friend of ours who claimed to find listening to the podcast soothing.
Might say something about how manic she is.
Well, yeah, it probably says more about her than it does about the podcast. That was certainly something we were never going for. But if you find it soothing, then I'm glad that we're fulfilling a niche in your day. If our voices are what is lulling you off to sleep at night, then, well, you'll probably have some very odd dreams.
We should hope so. Maybe we should do a sleep and dreams episode, and we just slow it down a bit, so we're all just like completely.
I think we should be capitalizing on it in a way. If people are using this as a kind of soporific and something instead of sleeping pills, then we should start slipping in more subliminal messages.
Buy our t-shirts at psychpizza.spreadshirt.co.uk.
When it's ready, when it's ready. But yeah, so good feedback, lovely.
My brother said that it was good, and he really laughed at some bits, but it should be shorter, but I don't care. I like things being long. I'm a post-rock fan. And he said, we should definitely sell it to medical students to revise for their psychology module, because basically they score points just by mentioning any study. So if we just make a study memorable, pretty much no matter what it is,
The eventual aim of this podcast is for it to be incorporated into the psychology curriculum.
I thought we were going to try and get a deal with CGP Books. Remember those guys?
Not at all.
Okay, well, I'll explain some other time. Anyone who does remember them is probably a child of the 2000s in high schools doing science. It's worth noting, by the way, if you are listening to this, go and look at the show notes at psychomedia.wordpress.com, because there are some secret funny things there each week, apparently.
But no reading list.
No, because it was an effort to do the first one, so I thought I'd do something else. So the second episode's show notes features some Scrabble words you can come up with using Pazinski's name, including a seven-letter spelling of picnics, which uses a great deal of Y's.
Yeah, I wasn't sure when I was reading. I mean, this is something of an aside that only people who bother to go to the WordPress page will be able to engage with. But I wasn't sure whether those were actual words that some internet thing had told you or whether you were just making it up. But
No, that was... I do put my effort into my jokes, but not that much effort. No, that is genuine. I checked it, and that is from like the official Scrabble words list. I checked.
Huh? Crazy. Well, in that case, I was a little miffed to see that you hadn't done a reading list, I have to say, Tim.
You want to do it, you can do it.
Yeah, I know, but I don't.
Precisely. That's the explanation.
I think if any of you particularly, for some obscure reason, want references for any of the studies, and we don't in that particular week provide them, then Twitter or email, and we'll send them through to you. We may even send the PDFs if we're feeling generous.
Oh yeah, with your access to journals. envious. I never thought I'd be envious.
Worth noting, there's a slight kind of, when it comes to the research for these podcasts, it's sort of for Tim, it's a lot harder for me because he has to go and find names of studies that look interesting, but he can't read them until he tells me about them and I go and get them, having access through the university.
Essentially, so you're my assistant now. That's what that proves. I am the mastermind, you're the assistant.
I feel it's more of a sort of dealer-addict relationship. But, I'm your source for all that psychological goodness.
It's true, Ben. I'm addicted to you. Okay, let's get away from the feedback and away from this line of conversation.
It's probably going to be a recurring theme in the podcast, given its topic. But anyway, let's move swiftly on. What have you done this week, Tim?
What have I done this week? I think what I've done this week is I've asked you, what have you done this week, Ben?
What have I done this week? Yeah, okay, I see. Well, carrying on from the trend from last week of watching films, this week I saw Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
No spoilers.
Which, oddly enough, is also set in New York. yeah, okay, so no spoilers. It is one where I could potentially ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it, so I'm not going to.
It was Alec Guinness.
Fantastic film, absolutely loved it. Ridiculously good cast. In particular, worth noting, I came out of that completely certain that I would happily watch a single close-up shot of Gary Oldman's face twitching for hours. For the full running length of the film, I would be happy to watch that. That is a man who can do more with a twitch than the entire cast of Twilight can do with three films, which is perhaps not saying very much.
No, not
really. The other thing about it was that... it saddens me greatly that Colin Firth and Mark Strong are not, in fact, a gay couple in real life, because they would be the sweetest of sweetest gay couples.
Better than Colin Firth and Nicholas Holt?
I have a very strong soft spot for Mark Strong, and I think they would work well together.
I'm not going to follow that line of questioning any further, Your Honour.
Probably best. Anyway, yeah, so that's what I did this week. Literally nothing else. What have you done, Tim?
Gone kind of neurotic and spare because I'm in charge of the house. My parents have gone away to Prague for their 30th wedding anniversary. That is Pearl. If you're counting, they got the most amazing card. It has a wheel that spins and like fills in all the bits on the front of the card so that it can cover 30. So it's like from first through to diamond wedding anniversary.
Wow. But so this is the one where they have to get each other programming languages, isn't it?
I gave them some money to buy themselves oysters, although I imagine that neither of them will actually do that on account of the fact that my mum hates fish and that my dad is, you know, sensible. But yes, so I'm in charge of the house, and you can imagine how stressed that makes me as a neurotic kind of individual. The exhaust is falling off my new car already, so that's not good either.
That was quick. Have you checked inside this one to ensure that it isn't composed entirely of rust?
No, it appears to be composed entirely of litter. It used to be my younger brother's car, but because he's going to university, he's donated it to me, and he hasn't quite tidied it up yet. He will. He's good at cleaning it. He's a professional cleaner, or was. Nevertheless, yeah. So I've had romance.
You're a medic.
No, my youngest brother.
Sorry.
Who is going to be doing sociology and social policy shortly. So he's going to be our boss one day, telling us exactly what to do, perhaps.
that's
but yeah, so I've had romance on my mind.
Yes.
Clearly. Thinking about my parents, happy relationship. And so I thought we should try and figure out how on earth did they get there? Because I don't
understand. Let's reduce this to base biological function.
Oh, well, maybe not that. I you know, there are lines that you don't really want to cross. But I realised that I don't understand relationships. I'm perpetually single. Incidentally, that is the answer to our question in the first episode. So, sorry, guys. None of you got it right. And by none of you got it right, I mean none of you sent me a postcard. Seriously, come on, guys.
Nobody responded.
I don't know what this week's competition is going to be. We haven't had any racist jokes either, as far as I know.
You guys are doing
better.
Very badly on your end of this deal. We're working really hard on this podcast. I really don't think you're pulling your weight.
You know, it's not us, it's you. But yes, yeah, so I thought I would try and look at some science to try and figure out this relationship thing, because that's basically my only chance of getting my head around it. I don't know, Ben, you probably know more about this than me. What are relationships like?
I'm not sure I would go so far as to say I know more about it than you. Possibly objectively that would seem to be the case, but I don't think that's particularly a nice thing to say about anyone.
Our objectivity, who cares about that? It's not like we're scientists.
The thought that struck me was that dedicating years of research to the psychology of relationships is kind of a bit like spending hours and hours and hours studying the molecular structure of a big delicious cake. In that you can see why it would be scientifically interesting, but you also can't help feeling that it's slightly missing the point. I apologize also for the recurring theme of reminding you about cake. I hope it doesn't make you too hungry. But I think it's worth doing, because when you think about it, using a big delicious cake as a metaphor for a relationship is actually quite appropriate. A lot of cakes look extremely delicious on the outside, but only some of them turn out to be delicious once you start eating them. Sometimes a cake which looks delicious can turn out to be dry and uninteresting once you actually try it. Sometimes even cakes which seem delicious to begin with can leave you feeling quite unwell once you've been eating them for a while. In such cases, one option is to stop eating the cake at the first sign of feeling queasy, knowing that you're unlikely to be able to come back to it later because someone else will probably have come along and eaten it. Alternatively, you can grit your teeth and keep eating until there's no cake left. You'll probably feel extremely unwell, though, and it may be quite some time before you feel like eating cake again. Of course, some people prefer to eat lots and lots of smaller cakes rather than one big cake. These small cakes can last anything from single mouthfuls to a few bites. They have the advantage that they don't tie you down to any one type of cake. You can have chocolate cake, lemon cake, Victoria sponge, or even carrot cake if you like that sort of thing. Eating smaller cakes can leave you feeling somewhat unfulfilled, but you can always have more than one cake at a time if you feel the need for something more substantial. However, doing this increases the danger of having an allergic reaction, and people who eat lots of cakes do often experience nasty rashes as a result. It's important, therefore, that you check any cakes carefully before you eat them to make sure of their contents. See if anyone you know has tried that cake before and find out how they got on with it. There is, after all, nothing worse than tucking into a delicious-looking cake only to discover that it contains unexpected nuts.
I feel like I've learnt a lot in the last 2 minutes. I've learnt a lot about you.
Yeah.
Although I was distracted. You said carrot cake, and I kind of started thinking about Christina Hendricks, but that's another story for another day. You know, she's going to be Wonder Woman?
She is?
I read a terrible interview with her, and it's just like, I don't, you know, you're talking about your current film role and your upcoming film role, but don't worry, I'm more interested in how you walk, your husband, and the way you dress. I hate The Guardian sometimes. I hate it so much. Like, why not, you know, talk about the through theme of geek productions from Firefly through to Wonder Woman, or, you know, something interesting about Mad Men, if there's anything interesting left to say about it. No, we care about, like, the way you touch your hair or something. It was terrible.
I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry also that you were distracted from the ridiculous overextended metaphor. Unfortunately, that probably would have been a one-line thing had it not just sort of it's a metaphor that keeps on giving, and I apologize for that. I got a little
good metaphor is like a cake.
A good metaphor.
You can
like...
bake a new one provided you have some eggs.
Excellent. Sorry, and for that, and we should probably move on to the science rather than the metaphors. So that's what I know about relationships. They're like cake.
Yeah, I don't feel as bad about the little experience that I have now.
I may be having a difficult conversation with my girlfriend sometime soon.
Yeah, well, at least you can have a difficult conversation with your girlfriend.
You could have a cake.
It's worth noting that we actually have a study on self-deprecating humour later, so I'll, you know, justify these jokes in a little bit. It's all part of a devilish plan.
I see. Anyway.
Devil's food cake plan. The first study that I am going to present today is about the most basic level of attractiveness. There was, at one point in the 80s, yeah, all of my studies are from the 80s, it's really going to be a 80s revival thing, everyone well, gets some 80s clothes.
All of mine are recent.
Oh, that's good. So, yeah, they tried to find what I would consider the kind of holy grail of attraction science, which they hadn't at that point, which was universal attraction. And so this fellow called Cunningham in 1986 did some quasi-experiments. I'm sure I used to know what quasi-experiments are, but I can't remember now, and so I just think it's funny. It's like, oh, well, I did some semi-science. And if anyone says, oh, that's what you mean by psychology, is it? Then I'll hit you in the face.
Oh, you put me to the post there. I was going to make a joke about sociology.
Oh, sorry. See also economics, geology.
Medicine. Physics.
I feel like we're straying further from the truth. So yeah, what Cunningham...
It's quasi-truth, Tim.
In a way, all truth is quasi-truth. But this isn't an English podcast. This is a psychology podcast. So yeah, what Cunningham did was measured responses, including romantic feelings and intentions, in what he called an international sample. So the women from Thunderbirds. Incidentally, the women from Thunderbirds are kind of respectively, like Lady Penelope is English, Tintin is Malaysian, and Grandma is American. So they do have an international sample of women.
That is literally all the countries.
I haven't heard of any others.
Well, I was going to say it's the Power Rangers, because they're the perfect geek demonstration of multi-ethnicity, and they are handily color-coded as well.
Geek demonstration of multi-ethnicity, by which you mean deeply racist and somewhat sexist.
Yes, that's exactly what I mean.
White Power Ranger! I wish I...
But then, again, Black Power Ranger, so it balances out.
Yeah, I suppose it does. So one of the things they did in this study was they didn't just look at romance, they also looked at personality and altruistic intentions. And apparently at this point in 1986, they hadn't figured out which facial features are attractive, which suggests that scientists had basically been uncomfortable in looking at it. Darwin had come up with some ideas about it, and then they just kind of left it alone for a while. So,
you can understand that, though, can't you? Because, I mean, it was the 80s. They were probably distracted by the hair.
Yeah, hair too horrifying for the study of science. Anyway, so yeah, let me quote from the article to kind of give you some background. He said, Darwin, in 1871, was struck by cultural differences in preferences for different skin colours and amounts of body hair, as well as such practices as teeth filing and lip ornamentation. Ford and Beach in 1951...
Ah, Victorian England.
Ford and Beach in 1951 documented the cross-cultural variability in admired body weight, breast size, and other aspects of the female physique, suggesting little consensus in aesthetic preferences. And science basically had given up in finding universal attraction at this point. They're just like, it's too cross-cultural. How are we supposed to study this only using Midwestern American white students?
That is where all psychology breaks down once the, as mentioned in the previous podcast briefly, once you can't study it with white American students, you can't study it, basically.
Yeah, it's terrible. And so he cites a number of papers finding that one's personality affects the type that one is attracted to, which came up in our real lives recently. As you may
remember. Oh, yes.
We went and saw a friend who will remain nameless for the time being. We could give her a code name. You got any ideas for a code name?
Well, we can do an obscure code name which already exists, but will require more explanation than is really worth.
Oh, don't explain it. Just give it to her.
Actually, given that we're both in a sort of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy mood, we could call her Smiley.
Smiley? I don't know. Smiley suggests that she's some kind of mastermind, and I'm pretty sure the story I'm about to tell is kind of conclusive proof that she isn't.
Actually, no, given her address sense, we should call her Taylor.
Taylor. Okay, so our friend Taylor was determined the other week to set me up with a woman. Which, incidentally, all my other female friends, what have you been doing? Seriously. She's the only one really who's offered to do that. It's almost as if that she has something...
It wasn't so much that she offered, it's that she insisted.
Oh, yeah.
And they did it despite your protestations.
Yes, yeah, so she tried to work out my type, and we used a little science and worked out that I didn't really have a type, per se, but she kept on asking me questions to try and work out...
No, hang on. The science was... She opened up her Facebook friends list and told you to scroll through them.
That was later.
Okay.
But no, before that, she was just like, okay, so do you like, you know, quiet women? Do you like some other types of women? And, you know, physical types, do you like tall women or athletic women or stuff like that? I'm trying to say, look, it's not quite like that. And I probably should have gone into some of these studies. If I'd had these studies to hand, it would be much easier. Eventually, she... gets to the point where she's like, oh, I think I've come up with someone, but it's just important I ask you one final question. I'm like, okay, what's this going to be? She's like, do you like boobs, Tim? Because this girl, even when she had anorexia, she never went below a C cup. It was the most bafflingly perverse thing anyone has ever said to me. And I know a lot of bafflingly perverse people.
That is...
How did she know that?
Oh, I see. I thought you meant, how did she know that you like boobs? No. Yeah.
I never actually answered the question, and I don't intend to because it's just too horrifying. Anyway, the point was...
So yeah, that was a terrible and harrowing experience that will reduce the estimation of our listeners of our friendship group.
Yeah, our friends are great. The point is that... different personalities affect whether you like girls who have been anorexic but remained curvaceous. That's the thing that we can get from that introduction. But if you want something else creepy, let me read some of the predictions, a bit from the predictions of Cunningham. Cunningham said, responsivity to a few mature features, such as high cheekbones or cheeks which have lost some of their baby fat, may have evolved to discourage paedophilia and ensure that advances were only made to post-pubescent females. Yeah.
Yay. Paedophilia, so early in this podcast. I thought we could probably hold out a bit longer, but I guess not.
No, basically Cunningham predicts that primarily the attractive facial features of a woman will be neonatal features, i.e. features that make them look baby-faced, with a couple of key mature features to make sure that they aren't actually babies, and then finally expressive features that give the impression of a constant style. He doesn't care about style. You can dress any way you want for Cunningham. A constant smile or attention or submission. Yeah.
He's just described manga.
Hey, you know, maybe.
Like that. That is exactly what he's describing there. Everyone thinks that manga is this sort of like weird, extreme, peculiar to Japanese form of sort of manga girls, precisely being kind of specific to Japanese culture or whatever. But according to Cunningham, manga is the universal attractive form.
Maybe he was just into it before it was popular. It was all a subtle plan to get all these psychologists and other geeks reading it, and it succeeded. Anyway, so he got together a kind of collection of photos of attractive and unattractive women, a pool of stimuli including faces from 28 countries. So yeah, united colors of objectification. The photos were randomly selected, except for the stipulations that the woman be smiling and not wearing glasses. There's good scientific reasons for it, but it does sound quite harsh. Just like, no spectacled girls in my study on attraction. They were half college students. Can you guess which part of the USA they were from? That's right. Oh, it was the Midwest. And half were...
Was Jennifer Aniston one of them as well?
Possibly. I don't know. She went to college somewhere where you can ski, because her and Jason Bateman got to be friends at the age of 20 because they went skiing together.
This is strike one in disturbing knowledge Tim has about people that you wonder how he acquired.
I read the internet. That's the thing you can read, right? Yeah, half of them were
almost to exhaustion.
And half were Miss Universe contestants. That's the photos, not the subjects, which is, you know, a bit of a blow for Cunningham. But mm-hmm. And all of them dressed normally so that no one would suspect that that some of them were Miss Universe contestants. And none of them did. He debriefed them. It's like, do you suspect any of these photos were from Miss Universe? And they were like, whoa!
The one with the tentacles.
And was, so they...
Such a stupid name for a contest. Such a stupid name for a contest. It is literally inviting alien invasion.
Yeah, but, you know, if I've learned anything from watching science fiction, and I have, it's that they're all kind of humaniform anyway. That even if they're of a reptilian or insectoid biology, they still have breasts.
That is true.
You know,
otherwise Captain Kirk would be a much more docile and dour individual.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see an episode of Star Trek: The Original Series where it is just like a horrifying Cthuloid monster, and just like, oh well, better sleep with it anyway, because I'm gonna, and that's apparently what I do. I was listening to a podcast the other day that I'm going to be on in a month's or so time, and they were discussing who is the best Star Trek captain. Do you know who the best Star Trek captain is?
I don't, Tim, and I pride myself on that lack of knowledge.
Well, I'm going to ruin it for you, because apparently it's Captain Sisko from Deep Space Nine. So you can never unknow that. they showed the photos to the participants, and a female experimenter asked them how attractive they were. Now, in psychology, we have a concept called ecological validity, which is the similarity of the experiment to the real world. How many times have we sat in that Cafe Nero on the high watching the women go by and talking about their attractive rating and being psychologists doing it on a properly standardized scale? You know, why was there no male experimenter asking this?
Sorry, was that being facetious, or were you genuinely referencing experiences that you thought we had?
Sorry, I thought that was with you. It was with a woman. I know a lot of bisexual women. That's just all it is. It was ecologically valid. I withdraw my objection. The study is ecologically valid because...
I think actually it is. I think it is because... Well, actually, no. You're right. They should have had a male experience there, because that is actually a really stereotypically ecologically valid situation.
Yeah, exactly. This was the
of guys sitting and rating girls. Although, I should say, the standard 1 to 10 scale generally used by men when objectifying women is, I feel, erroneous. It should be a true odd-numbered Likert scale, which should really be 0 to 10, because if you do 1 to 10, then you have... Is it that you have a midpoint? Yeah, you don't have a midpoint in that case.
Yeah, that is bad.
That is bad.
I would do 1 to 7, just because I prefer 1 to 7.
1 to 7 is objectively...
And I say I would. I don't know anyone who's ever done it in real life. Do you?
On a scale of 1 to 7... how good a scale is 1 to 7?
I would give it a 5, possibly a 6. Can I choose 5.5? Or is it one of those scales where you have to choose an actual bit? I feel we're getting distracted. So,
yeah.
What we found was that the attractive...
It's boring, unfunny psychology.
It's not unfunny, but it is boring. It's a weird contradiction. Anyway, so what they found was that higher and wider eyes... greater distance between the eyes, a smaller chin, and a smaller overall nose size were correlated with attractiveness of ratings. So those are all neonatal features. Prominent cheekbones and narrow cheeks, positively related to attractiveness. And higher eyebrows, larger smile, and dilated pupils, which are the expressive ones, positively linked to attractiveness ratings.
So now we're on Lily Cole High.
Yeah, I know, which can't be scientifically possible. Lily Cole is one of like few people in the world I have an active grudge against. Her and Emma Watson.
Are we getting into that now, or are we going to save that?
No, no, no. We'll save that for another episode. The three women who I have grudges against in the world. The other one is Angelina Jolie.
Is that just women, or is it just the three people that you have grudges against in the world that are all attractive women? Successful, attractive.
What are you trying to say? Don't psychoanalyze me. That's forbidden.
You are a strong, independent woman, Tim.
Strong, independent woman. I always wanted to be a cross-dressing Chandler Bing. Can I cosplay?
Moving on!
Yeah, so basically there's a very odd picture of the face that they used to show all these ratings. It's just like, yeah, between this bit and this bit, that is feature number 13. Cashier number 12.
Frankenstein's woman.
And what they found was that previous personality ratings for these attractive women were consistent yet ambivalent. So basically, when a man is asked what does he think this woman is like, he'll be like, oh yeah, she's nice, but she's maybe a bit vain, that sort of thing. Right. And so they went on and rated of the attractive women, their personalities, their willingness to do a variety of sacrificial and altruistic acts, like jumping on a terrorist and a grenade, or more terrifyingly, co-sign a $10,000 loan. And basically they found, again, this pattern of attractive personality qualities that were positive and negative. Attractiveness led men to say that women were brighter, more sociable, healthier, modest, but also assertive, fertile, but also more likely to have an affair. They would take physical, but not financial risks.
Sorry, Tim, I'm still fixated on sacrificial yet altruistic act.
As in... okay, jumping on a hand grenade, it's sacrificial and altruistic. It hurts you, but it saves someone else.
Okay, perhaps it's best if you stop trying to explain it, because the number of dirty jokes that is just running through my brain right now is frankly distressing. So,
Weird is I can't think of any of them, and that's good. But basically, that is a bit. And then they asked them, okay, what about your romantic intentions? What would you do with these women? And can you guess the three things that they said? They said date, mate, or procreate. It's a new TV Hooray! Show.
Date, mate. The problem is with, like, we're back to snog, marry, avoid again. Yeah. Or what's the more extreme version? Oh no, that's the one we can't broadcast, isn't it?
Freud, marry, or kill.
Freud, marry, kill. Yeah, that's the one.
Tam, marry, kill. We'll explain that another week.
Yeah, but the problem with that is that there's, you know, that is a nice. That is essentially a three-point Likert scale, isn't it? Positive, neutral, negative.
Are you saying marry is neutral? Which are you saying is neutral?
I will not respond to that question.
You don't want to incriminate yourself.
I do not want to incriminate myself. However, the date, mate, and procreate is like, that's 7, 6, and 5 on a seven-point scale.
Well,
I'm not saying which is which.
The point is that they... sometimes have different psychological qualities, and I think in another experiment you get different results when you ask mate and date.
Right.
But yeah, basically eye height and width, that's like the key one, this real neonatal wide-eyed baby-eyed feature that decides. Yeah. And so let me just read the conclusion to the study verbatim, because it's pretty funny, and then I'll let you talk about some science or something. Individual males also may differ in whether they fantasize about sultry, dark, relatively mature-appearing women or cute, bouncy, blonde and blue-eyed child women. Although both fantasies may include large eyes and a small nose, there may be differences in preferences for some features such as nose length, cheek width and coloration. Experiments linking perceivers' personalities with their hair, eye color, neonate and maturity feature preferences would be warranted.
Well, there we go. Yep. I think that's a big study to explain something which, as much of psychology is, slowly and painfully working out the surprisingly obvious. But it's, you know, it's necessary science, and it often produces amusing experimental designs.
Yeah.
So you've kind of demonstrated the key... sort of the basic biological universal attractive features. The study that I came across first when trying to come up with relationship-y stuff is actually surprisingly similar to that in both design and the kind of thing it's looking for. It's called Red and Romantic Behavior in Men Viewing Women, which would be ambiguous if there were such a thing as red behavior. It's not, so it isn't.
I think McCarthy thought that there was such a thing as red behavior.
Yes, communist and romantic behavior in men.
Alternatively,
women.
People who like the Warren Ellis comic book that was adapted into an apparently funny movie.
Yes, true also. Anyway.
Sorry, I'm interrupting you.
It's fine. It was by Kayser, Elliott, and Feltman, 2010. I will once again, these studies have a wonderful, I hope, tongue-in-cheek way of introducing their topics. If it's not tongue-in-cheek, then it's slightly distressing. However, here's the opening paragraph. In many non-human primate species, including baboons and chimpanzees, females display red on their body, e.g. chest, genitalia, when nearing ovulation. Research has shown that these red displays increase attraction behavior in male conspecifics, as indicated by increased masturbation and mounting attempts. Here, we examine whether a display of red by a human female increases attraction behavior in male conspecifics in an analogous fashion. Substituting red clothing for red... Yes, the final sentence is very important. Substituting red clothing for red chests and genitalia and question intimacy and physical distance for masturbation and mounting attempts.
Well, thank goodness for that.
Thank goodness for that final clause. Anyway, so basically they're interested in this idea that red, the color red, is an evolved signal for sexual attraction. There is quite a well-established kind of cultural trope of this. You just have to look for, the woman in red in The Matrix. I had another example, but I can't remember it.
Cylon number 6 in Battlestar.
Yeah, that's...
just looking. I'm sure I have her action figure around somewhere.
Although I suppose in film noir they tended to have been in black and white, so that probably wouldn't work, but it kind of... Oh, yes, Jessica Rabbit, that was the other one.
Okay.
It's kind of an established thing, the woman in red. What they were interested in is whether this has an effect, possibly due to some evolutionary function. So they did two experiments. The first one, they were kind of similar to Tim's in that they were asking males to give ratings on pictures that they showed them. In the first experiment, male participants were told that they were going to be carrying out an online interview with a woman.
Oh, what was the date on this study? Sorry.
2010.
Oh, wow. Recent.
Yeah, yeah. They were shown a picture of the woman, and the woman was rated as being of average attractiveness by a board of presumably judges who were presumably happy to be in the job that they were in. So it was like, I think, 4.5 on a 9-point scale or 10-point scale or something like that. Anyway, so it was an averagely attractive woman, and the woman was photoshopped to either be wearing a red or a green shirt. And what the participants had to do was they had to look at this picture and then choose questions from a battery of questions that they were going to ask in this interview. The reason that they chose the green shirt was it's a bright primary color, so it can't be... It's similar to red in that respect, and it's also a generally universal signal for go as opposed to red, which is stop. So they were kind of contrasting these two dimensions in case maybe having a green shirt encouraged people to go more at that woman.
Like at those weird rumoured parties that I've never been invited to.
Me neither. I have never even heard of them. Which
traffic light parties? You go and you wear a thing indicating your availability using traffic lights.
I feel like there were bops for that at Oxford. Bops, incidentally, being what Oxford
which made the party. Rubik's Cube bops rather confusing.
Yeah,
it's like, what does white symbolise?
Well, surely you have to rearrange your clothing so that you show all of one colour on one side. Anyway,
how many decades do you think it will take for Oxford to call parties?
For once, math students would actually do better at parties than humanity students. Anyway.
Ooh, cold.
Yeah, stereotyping. Hooray!
Okay, so green or red?
Green or red shirt.
It's like an ITV game show.
And what they found was that if the woman was wearing the red shirt, then the participants were inclined to pick more intimate questions, questions about love life and dating and that sort of thing. And this
How intimate did questions get?
Sorry?
How intimate did the questions get?
Let me see if I can find some examples for you. Oh, no, that's the other study. The basic finding, as I say, was that the questions were more intimate when the woman was wearing red, and that this was independent of participants' perceptions of their own attractiveness. So the questions were, there were 24 of them, from low intimacy, such as where are you from, moderate intimacy, where do you normally hang out, moderate intimacy, high creepiness factor, and high intimacy, high creepiness factor, how could a guy, brackets, I, get your attention at a bar? that kind of thing. So not hugely intimate, but certainly more so than Where Are You From?
Yeah, sure. And, you know, even if they're not hugely intimate, if it shows the behavioural change, that's what counts.
Yes, which is indeed what happened. So, yes, red draws more intimate questions. The second study was kind of a full-on behavioural one. Similarly, male participants were shown a photo of a woman who was this time photoshopped in a red or a blue top. They chose blue this time because A, it's different from green, and B, blue is apparently the most popular colour when... you know, you do big studies of what is your favourite colour. Most people.
Who gave those people funding?
Well, I don't know. It's interesting to know. In as much as any psychology is interesting to know.
Oh, yes, okay.
So, yeah, they were shown a photo of a woman that they were going to be having a physical interview with, as in they were going to be asking questions to them in person.
Rather than asking them using a physical, you know.
Yes.
Interpretive dance interview.
Hooray. But no. Yeah, so they were shown the photo of the woman, and then they were taken into the interview room, in which there was a desk with a chair at it, and then another chair placed sort of in the middle of the room, kind of in open space. And they were told that the woman was going to be seated at the desk and that they were to take the other chair. And basically, they measured how close the participants moved the chair to the desk based on... what colour of shirt the woman was wearing in the photo that they'd seen. I think there's kind of a bit of a tease, this study, because they were then told that the woman had a call and had to leave, and then they were just dismissed. So,
oh, that's so depressing.
It is kind of depressing in a way. And
did they control for people like me who hate to sit close to people?
I don't really... Well, I think if they found the effect anyway, I would suspect that people like you who don't like to sit close to people are in the minority. And
yeah,
even if it was a sample composed entirely of people who don't like to sit close to people, they may still well have found an effect. It's just the magnitude of the effect would be slightly different.
Yeah, like, yeah, fine.
You would still sit close to the person in red. It's just you'd be, you know, the person in blue, you'd actually be backing away against the wall.
Person blue scares me, Ben.
One particular interesting thing about this study, apart from its finding, which I think is kind of cool, was that the photo of the woman in the second experiment was taken from hotornot.com. Tim, are you familiar with hotornot.com?
I am, in as much as I know what the concept is, but there may be a good reason for that, and that's that the concept is included in the name.
That is true. It is a nice self-explanatory website. I just thought that was... interesting and quite...
Do they do the rating with numbers or with comparison like Mark Zuckerberg?
I don't think they were comparing the women to Mark Zuckerberg, no.
Man, that would be really bad, wouldn't it? It's like, yeah, a heterosexual man has clicked Mark Zuckerberg over you.
That is pretty bad. Anyway, yeah, so basically the finding was that when they were primed with a picture of the woman in the red shirt... they sat closer, 157 centimetres versus 183 centimetres. So all of 26 centimetres closer.
About a foot.
About a foot, which is significant, had a nice big effect size. And there we go. So
nice big effect size.
What? Like...
I don't think the letter epsilon has ever felt so naughty. incidentally, if I saw a woman wearing a red shirt... I'd stay away from her. Trouble is going to come down on that thing.
But that's, yeah, actually, they should have controlled for Trekkies, shouldn't they?
Yeah. You should do that basically in any situation. You can't trust a Trekkie.
Maybe that's why it happens in Star Trek. All the monsters just want to get closer to the red shirt. Anyway.
But their clumsy attempts at love leave the red shirts dead, so they have to settle for the guy in the yellow shirt.
There's a lot of Star Trek in this episode.
Once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your mixing up your references.
This is true. So
anyway, so basically what they've proven is that Christa Berg was right.
Yeah, exactly. Christa Berg, sadly,
cheek to cheek.
Right. Cheek to cheek, lady in red.
That's pretty cool.
That's a study in itself.
Can we go back to the 80s now? Can we use Christa Berg as a thematic time hole?
Well, you can, but there were one or two other things about this study. The first was...
Okay, that's fine.
There's only two pictures of women in it, so it is entirely possible that blue and green just weren't their colour. Which was actually mentioned by the experimenters as...
I love it when they mention these things.
that, you know, fashion was just wrong. The other thing, which is going to, I think, is a definite recurring theme throughout all these studies, is the same with your neonatal faces, it's the same with this one. They're all done about male attraction towards women. Yeah. I think only one of the studies that I found really sort of explicitly did it both ways, and it didn't really, it wasn't particularly interested in the gender differences. And yeah, you would kind of expect that maybe they were, though perhaps there are studies out there which have tested that.
Maybe. Especially but, at least in Britain, there's like a million female psychologists and just us two who are male psychologists.
That is true. We are the only male psychologists.
It's true.
Yeah.
Look it up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I do when I feel nervous and aroused, Ben?
If I said yes.
The answer is I tell jokes.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad. You don't lean.
No, it's like one of those euphemisms from Doctor Who. I don't dance. I don't lean. I tell jokes. What does that mean? No one knows. The sign and the signifier have been so separated. That's right, I went for some more postmodernism. But yeah.
Hooray. We should tell another study.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm doing. We all know that...
Get on with it then, Jesus.
Have you been watching Return of the Jedi? You know, there's that bit where Han's talking to C-3PO and he's just like, can you make sure you do this? And C-3PO's just like, blah, blah, blah. And no, wait, no, do this. And then finally it's just like, and get on with it. Why are you taking so long?
I do now and I remember that bit. Good. I think it's about as tangential as it can possibly be, but it does serve the
Don't
purpose
challenge
of balancing.
Me like that.
It does serve the purpose of rebalancing the Star Trek, Star Wars imbalance, which was coming out in this podcast.
You were the chosen one. You were being balanced to the geek, sin, whatevers. Anyway, good sense of humour appears on every single dating profile, but does it appear in our brains? Well, actually, lots of research says it does. But Lundy, Josephine Tan, and Cunningham, the cunning Tan? Cunningham, Tan
How
Tan.
How dare you?
Yeah, tan you. anyway, they wanted to know whether it was just like sense of humour was an unqualified attractive quality, that just being funny was as important or significant as being physically attractive. So they start with a very important sentence. Research spanning several decades has found that people value physical attractiveness in romantic partners. And it's sentences like that that give social psychology a bad name. The thing is, people assume that...
Once again...
All
the
social
Megalan Institute of slowly and painfully working out the surprisingly obvious. Thank you, Douglas Adams.
You know, QI, I think, has taught us that the obvious answers and the common sense answers aren't always right. And basically, we need to check. And that's what social psychology often is.
Just checking.
Other stuff that they included in the intro, men care about physical attraction more than women, especially if the relationship is purely sexual. But these aren't the only qualities that determine attraction. Hansen, in 1977, not the band, but a person called Hansen, found that the most popular ones in 1977 were pleasantness, cheerfulness, dependability, considerateness, a sense of humour, neat appearance, honesty, naturalness, affectionateness, intelligence, and having gone to see Star Wars in the cinema. And the last one is a lie.
Is it, though?
Well, I was going to say from earlier, the cake is also a lie by which I mean relationships. But yeah, Hansen, it's a bit chronocentric, you know, it's a bit focused on its time, neat appearance and such, you know.
I wish you hadn't said that now, Tim, because I'm now trying to interpret Portal in the context of my relationship metaphor.
Your girlfriend is the companion cube. I was going to say GLaDOS.
Now you're in trouble.
Well, what's she going to do? Kick me in a way that kills me in an instant blow? Oh, wait. So yeah,
oh dear.
Attractive people are considered to have many good qualities, such as social competence, confidence, power, happiness, moral goodness, and sexual warmth, not going any further on that, regardless of whether they actually have them, but also to have this what they call a dark halo effect of being vain, unsympathetic, unattainable, and rejecting. And
apart from the sexual warmth that you once again described the cast of Twilight.
Moral goodness, we'll not go there. We'll talk about the morality some other time. Perhaps probably not best. On a psychology podcast. but maybe we'll just do it in person. Anyway, women, more so than men, want humorous partners. This is all their intro research. And especially when it's a long-term relationship rather than a purely sexual one, so kind of the opposite of men's consideration of the importance of physical attractiveness. They briefly mention a researcher called Felmley, who did what I would call exit interviews on the end of relationships, where they asked what qualities made the relationship start, what made it good, and what made it fail. Sense of humour was listed both in the initial attraction and the dooming the relationship categories.
when you call it exit interviews, you do make it sound like, you know, the interviews that are given to sportsmen after a game.
Oh, right, that's not what an exit interview is.
I mean, we all went out there, we gave it 110%, but, you know, it was a relationship of two halves, and at the end of the day, she was the better team, and we came away a bit disappointed, but, you know, we're gonna come back strong for the next time and see if we can get a better result.
No, that's not what exit
interviews are. That's my footballer impression.
Yeah, it's quite good. Exit interviews are when someone is fired or made redundant, and you ask them, so how do you feel about the company now? But basically,
I see.
If you make too many jokes, it spoils the relationship, at least the romantic relationship.
I have seen no evidence of this between us.
Yeah, I know. Must not apply to bromance.
Guess not. So few things do.
I'm sorry for calling our relationship bromance. It's a horrible word. Anyway,
it is, rather.
Homosociality.
That's I do not.
Come on, Ben, I'm homosocial for you. I'm not homosocial for many people. I'm mostly heterosocial.
You're antisocial, Tim. I think we all know this.
Asocial. Anyway, so they looked at humour, especially self-deprecating humour, and they found that it only really works to increase attraction if all the other impressions make you seem brilliant. So if you come in and you're like, I am a top neurosurgeon and I look great and look at my hair because I use Hugh L'Oreal. You know, Hugh L'Oreal is advertising L'Oreal now? Hugh L'Oreal. But then I tripped over on your door on the way in to have coffee. I watched an episode of Seinfeld earlier. But then the attractiveness goes up than if they'd stepped in coolly and sublimely. But if they, like me, I'm just like, oh, I've just done a 10 stupid things in a row. And also, my physical and other qualities don't make me look amazing, which they do, but, you know, let's imagine they don't.
I was going to say, don't do yourself down.
Don't worry. There's no
bronzed
danger
Adonis.
That. it worked the opposite way. So they were showing that self-deprecating humour clearly cuts both ways, and it depends on the other qualities, which is not what you suggest, that you think that just sense of humour on its own was an individual, independent quality. So they did an actual experiment. Sorry it's taken so long to get to the experiment. They had a lot of intro, and I think it was interesting and relevant. So they had a mixed Canadian group, so they're mixed, and they're also Canadian, so you've got to factor in their attraction to bears. That's right, my one Canadian listener. I said you're attracted to bears.
I mean, not sexually, but bears are pretty cool.
Yeah, but not sexually. That's the key element. They presented pictures with writing that was ostensibly by the person in the picture, which was either humorous or not. They don't give many examples of the joke, except for one, which was, oh, I was so drunk last night, I hijacked an elevator and tried to go to Cuba.
What?
Is this thing on? Come on, comedy store. Oh, that's flash forwards. Anyway, so they asked the participants about their desire to have various romantic actions with, and also the personality of the person in the picture.
I think given that joke, I'd probably prefer the bear.
And this humour manipulation was extraordinarily successful. Can I tell you a number that will really arouse you? P was less than 0.001 on the humour manipulation.
My God. No, I was going to say really disturbing things about p-values there, but I'm not going to anymore.
Yeah, please. These were some absolutely killer jokes. So they found the obvious things. Attraction predicts romance. Men want more sex. But there was no main effect for humour. The person, if they, you know, just having being the humorous person didn't make them seem attractive, and they didn't make the person think, oh, I want to, you know, mate, date, procreate, matriminitate, and what was the last one? Oh, serious relationship 8. but they found an interaction with attractiveness. In the high attractiveness right. condition, humour predicted the desire for a serious relationship, if you'll forgive the irony, and marriage. Also, the gender had an impact. Women wanted men to be funny across like every type of relationship, whereas men found women less attractive if they were more funny, especially for the short-term relationships, which I think is interesting. And I think sexism and humour is something we'll have to like talk about some other time, because it's really interesting. Yeah. But I certainly think it is societally kind of demanded that women are the ones laughing at men's jokes rather than vice versa in attractive context. I think something bad.
They discuss it on the QI episode again about gender.
Oh, really?
Because they had two female comedians on there, and they were discussing the perception that there are no female comics. I'll do them a disservice if I don't get them right, so I'm not going to stay. I think one of them was possibly Ronnie Ancona.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, can't remember the other one. Okay. And yeah, they were talking about exactly this thing, that there is a perception that men should be laughed at and women should do the laughing, and despite it's the fact that. Yeah, anyway, interesting.
But, you know, psychologically, these kind of backed up that. The humour was purely self-deprecating, and they said, there are some general problems inherent in attempting to manipulate humour. Particular jokes are chosen because of the consensus regarding their humour content, and it is difficult to control the nature of the subject matter. Which is basically their way of saying, people find, you know, stupid jokes universally funny, whereas if you were just like, this person did this routine, and it's just like a Stuart Lee routine, so lots of pages, like a 10-page thing. might not work on everyone in the same way as jokes about being drunk or being stupid or falling down the stairs do.
Those are, you know, all inherently funny things.
I agree.
Except for the long-term physical debilitation that can result.
That's true. Anyway, thinking of long-term physical debilitation...
Really? That...
I'm
going to veto that segue because, I'm just going to veto that segue, and listeners will see why.
You're not a nuclear power. You don't get a veto on our security jokes council.
If, like, of the two of us in this podcast, we're probably both. Anyway, so this
final study. Can I be Russia, please?
If you must. This final study is... in no way related to the previous one, specifically not via Tim's segue. It is called, and this probably won't help a great deal, Alteration of Platelet Serotonin Transporter in Romantic Love. Yes, that's right, we're rocking sexy neuroscience. It is by Maraziti, Akiskel, Rossi and Cassano, 1999. And it is about love and obsessive compulsive disorder. So for this study, I'm afraid there will have to be a bit of science-ness at the beginning, which won't be very funny, but it's sort of necessary for the understanding, because the study is all about serotonin, which is a neurotransmitter, which is a thing that sloshes around in the brain and allows you to think things. So,
hey, that's verbatim from one of our first year lecture notes.
That is pretty much, well, it's verbatim from the medical lecture notes, that's for certain. anyway, so neurotransmitters, they are involved in signal transmission between neurons, nerves in the brain. There are two particular neurological systems which have been linked to romantic relationships in the past, and these are the dopamine and the serotonin systems. Now, dopamine is generally involved in reward and the sense of gratification you get when you're rewarded. So if you do a task where you get, you know, money or even just like points for doing a task, you'll get the dopamine system becoming active. And apparently, according to a guy called Clone Ninja,
Clone Ninja. I love Clone Ninja.
Clone Ninja has an excellent name. Unfortunately, it's not spelt as in Clone Ninja, which would have been much cooler. In 1986, he postulated that dopamine is a significant factor in sexual behavior with multiple partners. Many small cakes, according to the introduction. And this was sort of related to people having a thrill-seeking personality and therefore having lots of the sex.
giving them a sense of reward. Serotonin, on the other hand, is generally associated with more long-term emotional states. So being happy or being sad, those sensations are associated with the serotonin system. It is also dysfunctional in depression and other anxiety disorders. And conditions like that are treated using antidepressants called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So depression is an example of one of those. There is another disorder which comes under this sort of blanket heading of anxiety disorders, which is obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. And this is also treated with SSRIs. So the obsessive tendencies and kind of obsessional anxiety you get in OCD is alleviated by taking antidepressants that target the serotonin system. The problem with studying this is it's quite difficult to test levels of serotonin and dopamine in the brain, because you have to try and extract some of the essentially central nervous system matter that contains these neurotransmitters, which is generally cerebrospinal fluid. Extracting fluid from your spinal column is not a particularly nice experience, so it's, you know, you can't do it.
You can't just put in a straw.
Unfortunately not.
I've been doing this wrong.
Neuroscience, you're doing it wrong. So this is a problem. However, there is evidence to suggest that serotonin also turns up in your blood. Specifically, and I'm afraid it's getting more and more complicated, there is a particular protein called the 5-HTT protein, which you can find in the platelets in your blood, platelets being the little cell fragments which are involved in forming blood clots, amongst other things. 5-HTT is what's called a serotonin transporter protein. 5-HT is the name for serotonin, so you add the extra T on the end and you get 5-HTT serotonin transporter. So now we have a tiny, really, really simplistic explanation of how synapses work in the brain. So synapses are the junctions between two neurons, two nerves. Nerves obviously transmit signals around the brain, which forms the basis of thought and etc. And when two nerves meet, they connect with the synapse. So what happens is...
Well, this is the romance episode.
Yes, we've suddenly derailed into hardcore neuroscience, but it will eventually be dragged back to romantic love. So yeah, a electric signal comes down neuron number one, reaches the end of the neuron, and causes a release of neurotransmitter, such as might be serotonin, into the gap between the neurons, which is the synapse, the synaptic cleft. The yes, cleft is objectively a funny word. The neurotransmitter then kind of sloshes its way across the cleft and binds to the to neuron number two on the other side of the synapse. And this binding causes a change in voltage of that neuron, and that transmits the signal. What you have then is all this neurotransmitter kind of sloshing around in the cell, and you need to remove it before the synapse can work again. So you have what's called transporter proteins, such as the 5-HTT serotonin transporter protein, which come in after transmission and remove all the serotonin from the synapse. What we have found, the authors of this this study that I'm talking about now did a previous study where they found that levels of this serotonin transporter protein in the blood of people with OCD were significantly lower, suggesting dysfunction of the serotonin system, and explaining why giving people serotonin-targeting antidepressants helps alleviate the symptoms. So this is where we find people with OCD have dysfunctional serotonin systems, as evidenced by this transporter protein in the blood. The authors reasoned, and this is where the love comes in, that the kind of obsessional tendencies and obsessive thought patterns you get in a romantic, loving relationship might be kind of similar to the obsessions you get in OCD, at least at a biological level. I'm quoting from the study verbatim. They say, the similarities between an obsession and an overvalued idea, such as that of typical romantic love, suggest a possible sharing of common alterations at the level of the 5-HT transporter.
Man, someone recently got dumped, didn't they?
Well, it's you will see that there's a slightly odd attitude towards romantic love by these authors, which we'll come to in a moment. So the study was actually relatively simple. They had 20 medical students recruited due to having recently fallen in love. The scientific criteria for having recently fallen in love was that obviously the students self-identified as having fallen in love and that this had happened within the previous 6 months, that they thought about their partner at least 4 hours in a day, and interestingly that they had had no sexual intercourse.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which, yes, is particularly interesting. We'll come back to that in a second. Then the comparison group were 20 people with OCD and 20 non-in-love controls, I think. I might have got the number wrong, but yes. So basically what they found was that, as previously determined, levels of this 5-HTT serotonin thing in people with OCD were significantly lower, but that... this was also the case in people who were in love. They had essentially clinically diagnosable dysregulation of their serotonin system as a result of being in love.
And that's insane.
Interestingly enough, the levels of 5-HT in people with OCD were indistinguishable in terms of the amount from those of people who were in love. They were exactly the same kind of levels.
Wow, that's crazy.
Which is kind of crazy and awesome in all in the same way. It's kind of, look, here's a neurobiological basis of one component, at least, of love, which is kind of fascinating. And I like this study in particular because oftentimes when you hear people giving kind of crass, cliched arguments against, you know, the objective empirical view of the universe that science provides and suggesting that there must be more to life than science, and saying, you know, science can't explain love. Yeah, can explain love, at least in this context.
If I could quote an old professor of ours, in order to study love, one really must look at the prairie vole.
Who was
doesn't
that?
Always get it, you know? But this case, yeah, it's an incredible discovery, really, yeah. That your brain goes all weird. If you were to, for example, switch a light switch on and back off 29 times, say, would that diminish your feelings of love? Because clearly the thing that's being shared here is like the obsessional side, but are you either saying that you could get rid of love with a compulsive behavior, or that the compulsive behavior might actually be sex?
Well, yeah, this is the really interesting thing. So the lack of sex, sexual intercourse in the participants is particularly critical here. The authors, in their discussion, the way they justify this criteria is based on the writings of a guy called Stendhal.
That sounds familiar, but I couldn't tell you what he did.
He was around in the 1800s. He was a sort of an author and poet and romantic and
flagrant
womanizer. So in 1842, this guy Stendhal wrote about true love being unconsummated passion. Now, that's, you know, I think a lot of people would probably have some debate on whether true love must necessarily be unconsummated. It's worth pointing out that this is the only justification that the authors of the study provide, this writing in 1842 by a guy who was a notorious womanizer obsessed with his sexual conquests, at least according to Wikipedia. What is less debatable was that he died of syphilis, which might potentially explain his slight obsession with romance that didn't involve consummation of the relationship.
I mean, if you alter it slightly and say the most intense form of love
could be
is the unconsummated passion.
Could be.
So I think that you could argue that more easily than the true.
Yeah, I think so.
Truth and love are hard to define, especially if you've spent your life trying to denounce their evils.
This is undeniably so. Small aside, Stendhal lends his name to Stendhal syndrome, which is the peculiar condition that some people experience whereby they have shortness of breath, heart palpitations and fainting when they're exposed to particularly stunning and usually large pieces of art or architecture.
Wow.
Which is,
I've never heard of that.
Apparently a thing. I heard it first referenced on QI, and this is all from the Wikipedia page about Stendhal. I make no bones about that. Go and read it. It's quite interesting, particularly the Stendhal syndrome stuff. So the final thing about this study was that they didn't report it as a kind of a significant result, but they mentioned that they tested six of their subjects 12 to 18 months into the relationship. And they found at this point that levels of the serotonin transporter protein in their blood were back to normal. Now, what they didn't say was, A, whether in that space of time the relationship had been consummated. You kind of assume that it had. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting. Maybe this sort of obsessional thinking style is part of the initial first bloom of romance with your partner. And, yeah, once you've kind of settled into a routine, maybe the obsessional side of things diminishes. I don't know. It's really interesting.
I mean, clearly, love is not the same throughout a whole relationship.
No.
Apparently. But it's taken out a super injunction to deny us talking about whether or not love is the same throughout the relationship. But yeah, I think that sounds in line with what you might expect.
Yeah.
It starts with this kind of fiery, passionate longing, and
particularly
it takes
when
on
intimated.
Yeah, it takes on a lot of different forms as a relationship goes on.
Mm.
And I'm sure sometime we'll talk about the fire triangle of love, that there are like three elements that all true lasting relationships need, and only one of them is passion.
Yeah.
You know, you need passion and you need companionship and you need a third thing that I can't remember because, hey, you know.
Cake.
Stop talking about cake, man. I had a really nice cake this week.
I'm hungry, yeah.
For it, there's none left.
Was it a big cake or a little cake?
It was a big cake.
What flavour of cake was it?
It was jam and buttercream flavour.
Oh, I see.
Mostly buttercream. Don't look at me like that.
I'm looking at you like that down the internet.
Shall we draw some conclusions?
Yeah, I think we should draw some
conclusions. In our longest episode yet.
Oh.
You know, every week we say we're going to have a shorter episode this week. And every week we get a longer episode.
Well, maybe we'll cut some stuff out, but we'll leave me saying that in so that you have to wonder if there's anything you've missed.
Exactly. Secret extras.
Then we can make a DVD director, yeah, extended edition that lasts 12 hours.
Yeah, me and Ben have been talking non-stop since last week.
Anyway, conclusions. You can reduce every aspect of human attraction to biological processes. Love is a sham. Men are pigs. Humor means nothing. And
hey, it does if you're already attractive. So well done, Jack Whitehall. Less well done, Milton Jones, possibly.
And
that's harsh to both of them.
So like the ideal romantic pairing is a child wearing red with high cheekbones and a funny male movie star on a roller coaster with OCD.
Isn't that called hard candy? Hey,
to Peter.
I made my pop culture references out of the 80s. I'm free. I'm
He's
free.
Escaped.
And everybody Excellent. Is free.
So,
okay.
Having escaped from the 80s and explained romantic love, Tim, do you have any particular conclusions?
As usual, that there's a whole load of unconscious processes going on in things that we think we understand, and that they're biological and they're kind of hardwired, and it's a bit depressing, really.
I don't know that it is. I think when you study psychology and neuroscience and that stuff, you are continually being bombarded with explanations for, you know, things that you do that turn out to be much less consciously controlled than you would perhaps think. But, you know, in a way, it doesn't fundamentally change, you know, the human condition, the human experience or anything. And yeah, it's kind of cool. I mean, if you were agonizing, if you were in the first 6 months of a romantic relationship, an unconsummated romantic relationship, it's kind of rare these days, but anyway, God, I sounded old then.
In
my day, we didn't consummate relationships until we were married. Anyway, that sort of thing. If you're having these terrible obsessional thoughts about someone and they're kind of racking your mind day and night, you can just be like, oh, well, it's just my serotonin. I'll take some antidepressants and then I won't feel so in love. That's the conclusion.
And I'm supposed to be the one who's bitter about the whole romance business. Shall we say goodbye before you say some more things that will A, get you in trouble with your girlfriend, and B, make everyone think that you hate relationships?
For the record, I do not hate relationships. They're like delicious cake. let's draw it to a close there. As always, any feedback, comments, complaining about the fact that we can't seem to make these damn things shorter, post
it
on...
I'm going to get it in the neck from my brother.
Yeah, getting it in the neck from me. send us emails at psychomediapodcast@gmail.com, or Tim will now ask you to go on his Twitter.
Yes, at TetrarchAngel on Twitter, or at YalFarf, I can't be bothered to spell that, on Last.fm, or Timothy Swan on Google, because I'm the number one result. Oh, yeah.
Nice. Thank you for listening. I don't know what next week's is going to be about.
We'll talk about that later. It'll be a surprise. It may even be surprise.
Yes. Anyway.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Call 0898-7792-663342 to get through to the Psychomedia chat line. One-on-one psychological chat. We'll cater to your naughty neuroscientific, bad behavioural or carnal cognitive fantasies. We have girls right here, right now, who just can't wait for you to call in and talk about peer-reviewed research. For an extra premium, we'll even talk about the F word. So, boys, call Psychomedia now on 0898-7792-663342. A filthy £5.70 per minute.
Oh, God.
You know, I got the voice for that purely from Marks and Spencer's adverts. Also, the number is 0898 Psychomedia.
Good. I'm glad. I'm not sure how much of this last little bit we're going to include, but I would really like it if you can include my agonized sigh.
It doesn't sound agonized. That's the thing. Why is it sounds quite okay, different, so I'm definitely leaving it in.
Oh, God. right, well, that's fine.